As you can see, everything is perfectly organized in alphabetical order. Oh, there it is. Okay. Okay. Well, it's a great honor to be here, and thank you very much for coming out for this talk, but also for the whole weekend, July 4th, Independence Day. It is very hard to be here in Chicago when we see what's going on the border of this country, the U.S.-Mexico border. What do you see when you look into the eyes of a child? Until Monday, over 350 migrant children, this was two Mondays ago, were jailed in filthy, unsafe conditions by U.S. Customs and Border Protection in Clint, Texas. The few outsiders who were able to see these migrant children were universally appalled, facing national outrage. CBP, Customs and Border Protection, it's hard to imagine that word protection in there, moved the children out, only to return 100 kids the next day. NBC reported that this place that was set up for perhaps 100 people actually weeks ago had something like 700 or 900 people packed into it. One who seems content jailing children is Acting Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director Mark Morgan, who President Trump has just made their chief jailer by naming him acting head of Customs and Border Protection. He said on Fox recently, "I've walked up to these individuals that are so-called minors, 17 or under, and I've looked at them," Morgan told Fox News primetime host Tucker Carlson last January. He said, "I've looked at their eyes and I said, this is a soon-to-be MS-13 gang member." And then you wonder how it's possible that these children locked behind plexiglass when Congress members are coming through. One Congress member described seeing these kids horrified. Congress member Dean from Pennsylvania, she didn't know what to do. She took a piece of paper and she wrote the word, "I heart you," and she put it up. And she said the kids then slipped a piece of paper under the door that said, "How can we help you?" And she started to cry. She said, "They're asking how they can help us, a congressional delegation." Very few people have access to these children. So getting accurate information about their welfare is very hard. But in Democracy Now!, we spoke to Warren Binford. She's a law professor at Willamette University in Oregon. And she was part of a legal team that exposed the conditions at Flint. She described what she saw on Democracy Now! She said, "When we got there, we were taken aback by the number of very young children, over 100 of them. We immediately asked the guards to start to bring us the youngest children, also the children who've been there the longest. We saw there were about half a dozen child mothers and their infants, so we asked the guards to also bring us those children. They managed to interview like 60 of the kids." She went on, "They were sick, they were coughing, they had runny noses, they were filthy, dirty. They immediately started to describe the level of hunger that they were experiencing. Their horror deepened with each interview. We found out that virtually no one is taking care of these children directly, that they're locked up in these cells 24 hours a day. There are open toilets in many of these cells. There's no soap, no way to wash their hands. They're being fed in these cells. Many of them are being forced to sleep on concrete because of a shortage of beds and mats and sleeping space. Guards handed toddlers to older children and told them to take care of them. Right, handed a two-year-old to an 8, a 10, and a 15-year-old. They don't even know this child. Say, take care of this two-year-old, this sick two-year-old. Warren Binford said, after the second day of interviewing these children, we had a high-level urgent meeting in my hotel bedroom, she said. She said they made the unusual decision, because they're sort of allowed into these places on the basis that they won't go public. She said, we made the unusual decision to contact the media because they concluded someone is going to die. Clara Long is a researcher with Human Rights Watch. She was along with this team. She told us about a quiet girl around 7 or 8 years old. She seemed like she would be like in second grade in the United States. She said, I said, who did you cross the border with? And the little girl said, my aunt. And then she just started crying so hard she couldn't produce words. I'm trying to calm her down, rubbing her back. And I noticed she had a bracelet on. And that bracelet had the words in permanent marker, U.S. parent, and a phone number. Long continued, there's this sense you're not allowed to use your phone in these facilities, but at that point, I and other members of our team just decided, screw them. We're going to start making phone calls. So right there with a little girl rubbing her back, she picked up her phone and dialed the number on her bracelet. And she was speaking to this little girl's father. He had no idea where she was being held. So the idea that it would take a, you know, just a bureaucratic catastrophe there, how are they ever going to find these parents? A number of them are wearing bracelets with phone numbers of their parents in the United States. Warren Binford said she believes something like 86% of these children have a parent or relative in the United States who could take them. She said there are many children being held by CBP that they can know who their parents are immediately just looking at their arms. The plight of the migrants and asylum seekers was underscored when the Mexican newspaper La Jornada published a photo of that Salvadoran father and his little daughter drowned in the Rio Grande, her little arm still around his neck. Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez was 25 years old. His little girl was 23 months old. Her name was Valeria, swept away by the rushing waters between Matamoros, Mexico, and Brownsville, Texas, after being turned back at the border when seeking legal asylum. Democracy Now! Recently was at that place between Matamoros and Brownsville. We went back and forth over the border. We had much more privilege than the Guatemalan mother and her two-year-old who were at the border when we were there, had been there in the hot, baking sun day after day. It's not the migrants who are breaking the law, it's the Trump administration. We have laws, and there's international law about letting asylum seekers in. I didn't say they can necessarily stay permanently in the United States, but they get their day in court. They get to apply for asylum. And the Trump administration is not allowing them to enter. And so you have like the mother and daughter we spoke to, mother and a little daughter waiting day after day. And so that's what happens. And that's what happened to Oscar and his little girl, Valeria. After waiting and waiting and waiting, they try another way. They try to make their way through the water. and so many of their lives are imperiled, as we saw with that photograph. Responding to a question about the photo, President Trump predictably blamed the Democrats for his border catastrophe. The immigrant detention system did grow dramatically under the Obama administration. There's no question about that. But the Trump administration has expanded it so much further with an unheard of level of cruelty. At least 6 children have died, not to mention the adults. But at least 6 kids have died while detained by Trump's Department of Homeland Security. Before last year, it had been more than a decade since a child died in the custody of U.S. immigration officials. Last week marked the first 2 Democratic presidential debates. Less than an hour away from the Miami venue where these 20 candidates debated, in Homestead, Florida, more than 2,000 unaccompanied minors are being incarcerated in a for-profit detention center run by Caliburn. Trump's former chief of staff, General John Kelly, sits on its board. Debating the fate of jailed migrant children is absolutely critical, but the life and death crisis that they've been thrown into demands immediate action. We must abolish all migrant child jails now. And of course, you know about the incredibly important reporting that has come out this past week. Incredibly important reporting from ProPublica by AC Thompson, who's done such important work on issues of police brutality, as well as what's been happening on the border. And I don't know how many of you heard Democracy Now! This week on when did we have him on this week on Wednesday? But his report on border agents caught posting racist, sexist messages about migrants in a secret Facebook group. You must read his reporting. Customs and Border Protection has opened investigation, they say, into the posting of racist and xenophobic messages by current and former border agents on a secret Facebook group. More than 9,500 people are part of the group, which was exposed on Monday. That's when the piece came out. The Facebook group is filled with racist, homophobic, anti-immigrant, misogynistic content about migrants and asylum seekers, as well as public officials like Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's depicted in a Photoshopped image being sexually assaulted by President Trump. In another thread, members of the group made fun of a video of a man trying to carry a child through a rapid river in a plastic bag. Someone commented, at least it's already in a trash bag. It is so horrifying. We're not talking about a few rogue border agents. We're talking about 9,500 people involved in this secret group. I'm not saying all of them are posting this kind of hateful responses, but a great number of them. So this part where AOC is being sexually assaulted by Trump, a reporter asked her about the depiction, and Congressmember Ocasio-Cortez said it was, quote, indicative of the culture she observed inside the migrant prison she just visited, and said she did not feel safe around the Border Patrol officers. She said, in that last facility, I was not safe from the officers there. I mean, she said, it's just indicative of the violent culture. The Hispanic congressional delegation went to Clint, Texas. And Joaquin Castro, right, the brother of Julian Castro, who's running for president, Joaquin Castro, head of the Hispanic Congressional Caucus, he somehow got a way to photograph, even though they had the Border Patrol taken most of the cameras away, and showed AOC hugging the women on the floor, showed the horrible conditions. And just a few days ago, the New York congressional delegation held a news conference in Foley Square in New York, and Congressmember Nydia Velazquez said, "There's the most chilling part. The people behind these posts are responsible for the well-being of the most vulnerable among us. Children, pregnant women, families. They're enduring desperate conditions, and these posts suggest they're literally in the hands of the people who engage in vile, racist online behavior." Everyone should read this report. And at the same time that A.C. Thompson's report came out, the Department of Homeland Security released the most vivid depiction, the photographs of what was going on inside of these detention centers. It's the Office of the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security. All of this happening at once. Is it any surprise that it's this week that President Trump ramps up his threats against Iran? I mean, what is the connection? Well, President Trump, I guess. But, you know, the watchword would be distraction. But this horror that we're seeing on the border, how often it's happened in Democratic and Republican administrations, that when something really difficult is happening at home, you just look for the enemy abroad. And that's exactly what Trump is doing. It didn't help him much that there was this just astounding court hearing this past week. As the Trump administration argued in federal court that the government's not required to provide toothbrushes, soap, or beds to children detained at the border, Justice Department Attorney Sarah Fabian made this argument before a three-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. All three judges repeatedly questioned the government's claim. This is Judge Wallace Tashima. He says, if you don't have a toothbrush, if you don't have soap, if you don't have a blanket, it's not safe and sanitary. Wouldn't everybody agree with that? Do you agree with that? Sarah Fabian says, well, there is fair reason to find that those things may be part of safe and sanitary, she said. Judge Wallace Tashima said, not maybe, are a part. What do you say, maybe? You mean there are circumstances when a person doesn't need to have a toothbrush, toothpaste, and soap for days? Sarah Fabian says, well, I think in CPB custody, it's frequently intended to be much shorter term, so it may be that for a shorter term stay at CPB custody that some of those things may not be required. Then Judge Marsha Berzon also pointed out that detained children are forced to sleep on cold cement floors with just an aluminum blanket. She said, are you really, the judge said, going to stand up and tell us that being able to sleep isn't a question of safe and sanitary conditions? Sarah Fabian said, Your Honor, I think what I'd like to stand up and say, Judge Berzon said, you're not really going to say that. And Fabian said, is to focus the court on what the real question is, she said. That's what's going on in the courts. And the courts are making an enormous difference, at least for now, because Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is moving full speed ahead. He considers his most important mission is to get as many judges approved as he possibly can at every level. And we already see what's happening at the Supreme Court. The courts are absolutely critical, but it's activism on the ground that makes such an enormous difference. One of the actions that took place in the last week that was so deeply moving were the Japanese American elders who went from where they live in places like California Oklahoma, and they made their way to Fort Sill, where hundreds of children are expected to be incarcerated. Because now they're looking beyond the border, but to incarcerate children throughout the United States, particularly in the South. But one of those places is Fort Sill. And these Japanese American elders went to testify about their own experience being incarcerated. And yes, validating Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they said, "We call them concentration camps. That's what we call where we were incarcerated in World War II." You know the story of 1,200 Japanese Americans or people of Japanese ancestry in this country rounded up in, not 1,200, 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry. And so these Japanese elders in the last years of their life made the journey to Oklahoma to testify about their own experience. And the security guard at Fort Sill, guards came out, and one of them was pushing them around, telling them, "Get off the property." He said, "Do you even speak English?" To these elders who've lived in this country for more than half a century. And they said they won't stop speaking out. And this is the kind of creative actions that are happening everywhere. You know, on Sunday, on a completely different issue, was the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, of the Stonewall Uprising that launched the modern day LGBTQ movement. Right, on June 28th, 1969, trans and gay and lesbian patrons of this bar in Greenwich Village fought back against yet another police raid, and this time they said no, and it caught on like wildfire, and people throughout New York came. It was led by trans activists like Sylvia Rivera. They fought back, and now over 50 years later, it took 50 years, the New York Police Department has apologized for their behavior. But what happened on Sunday in New York was astounding. And it hardly got the coverage that to show the enormity of what took place. Early in the morning, around 9:30, people gathered at Stonewall, about 50,000 people. That was the smaller part of the day. And did you know this, if you don't live in New York, and even if you live in New York, and even if you're sympathetic, I don't think you have every network today covering President Trump's speech in Washington, D.C. But the power of this movement on Sunday, 50,000 people gathered at Stonewall. Now, these were the activists who were protesting. You know, among their signs were, "Stonewall was a riot, we will not be quiet." And they were talking about everyone from Chelsea Manning still being incarcerated for refusing to speak to a grand jury, to homeless trans youth, to the killing of black trans women that is going on horrifyingly every month, every terrifyingly, it seems, even more than that in this country. And they marched, and when they passed Trump Tower and when they passed Fox News, they had choice words. And they marched and they gathered in Central Park after hours of marching in the hot sun, and they rallied, and the original activists who are still alive held forth. Larry Kramer spoke from a wheelchair and said, "We have failed," he said. "We have failed." Then I left about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 o'clock, came back on the subway downtown and thought, the second rally, that was the anti-corporate, anti-police brutality rally that had taken place. But the second one, I think it was called World Pride March, it was still going and going. This wasn't a protest. This was an absolute celebration. Yes, it was sponsored by every corporation under the sun. They could not, I mean, they were lined up so far. I mean, there was Joe's garbage truck and people were dancing in the garbage truck. There was every bank and people, you know, the workers, the banks, they were in these floats. This went on and on and on. It was past midnight. There were over 4 million people. This was one of the largest gatherings in the history of this country. And it was actually a celebration. It shows how times have changed. And for people who think that we have to, I mean, how can, what will change in this country? The change is happening, it's underway, it's underfoot. For every child that's incarcerated right now, the mass protest that's taking place all over this country, for every abortion ban that is passed in state after state, the kind of galvanizing that's going on across the political spectrum, I mean, most Catholics are pro-choice, right? Most people in this country, including Republicans, are pro-choice. And yet you have these Republican legislatures, because of gerrymandering, passing ban after ban. This is only galvanizing people further. There is enormous hope in this country for people's anger, how they feel, on everything from climate change to LGBTQ rights, to what's happening to children and families. I mean, once again, President Trump announced this week that within 2 weeks they will start rounding up thousands of families to deport. He just announced this again, made this threat. He made it 2 weeks ago, and then he was applauded for putting it off, right? He makes the threat, and then he's applauded for putting it off. And now he's made the threat again, and says another 2 weeks, so I guess he'll be applauded in 2 weeks' time. But of course, what stops it from happening are people rising up everywhere. Which brings me to what has just taken place in Washington. President Trump gave his speech telling his version of the history of this country. It was a military history. I don't know how many of you may have just seen it right now. He gave the speech about 6:30 that was, he would stop every 10 or 15 minutes for another flyover of a show of military weaponry with tanks that were brought in. Even generals have said July 4th is not the time to celebrate the military, that they have their holidays, that this is a time to talk about what makes this country not Donald Trump great, but imagine if what was happening in Washington right now are the striking teachers and those who struck in the past and those who are gonna do it in the future, they were marching, and public school children were marching, and doctors and nurses and paramedics were marching. Imagine if artists were marching. This is what makes this country great. This is what we have to celebrate. When we resort to the military, that is a complete failure. And that is what makes what President Trump is doing around Iran so terrifying right now. This week, my colleague Dennis Moynihan and I wrote a column about Iran and North Korea. Axis of Evil first appeared in former President George W. Bush's State of the Union address in January 2002, describing Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. This was months after the September 11th attacks. 14 months after the speech, the United States invaded Iraq. The U.S. remains at war there. 16 years later. Oh, by the way, in President Trump's speech today, he declared total victory in Iraq and Syria. Now, President Trump is threatening Iran with obliteration while he visits and showers praise on North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Why the different treatment of these two remaining countries in their axis of evil? It's simple. North Korea has an estimated 20 to 60 nuclear warheads and the missiles to deliver them, and Iran lacks nuclear weapons. The lesson is painfully clear. To avoid a devastating war with the United States, develop nuclear weapons as a deterrent. Despite what many Trump critics are saying, including many of the Democratic presidential contenders, Trump's brief meeting last week with the North Korean dictator was a good thing. Diplomacy is better than war. A war with North Korea would be catastrophic. Joe Cirincione, the president of Plowshares Fund, which works globally to reduce the dangers posed by nuclear weapons, told CNN a few years ago, "You strike North Korea, they're going to strike back. They have a devastating conventional arsenal built up on the border that could lay waste to Seoul. Estimates are that hundreds of thousands of South Koreans would die in the first few hours of combat, from artillery, from rockets, from short-range missiles. And if this war would escalate to the nuclear level, then you're looking at tens of millions of casualties," he said. Those are just the predicted deaths in South Korea. Add potential nuclear strikes on Japan, Hawaii, and possibly the US mainland, and the casualty figures would become unimaginable. We should be grateful that Trump is pursuing negotiations with North Korea. Yes, we should congratulate him on becoming the first sitting US president to set foot in North Korea. One opponent of such dialogue, though, is Trump's National Security Advisor, John Bolton. While Trump was in the Koreas last week, Bolton was dispatched far away to Mongolia. After the New York Times reported that Trump was considering accepting a North Korean nuclear freeze as opposed to complete denuclearization, Bolton tweeted, "Neither the NSC staff nor I have discussed or heard of any desire to settle for a nuclear freeze by NK," he said. Bolton and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo are also widely believed to favor a military conflict with Iran. Iran shot down an unmanned US spy drone recently, alleging it had entered Iranian airspace. The US said it was international airspace. Trump ordered a military strike in retaliation, then called it off at the last minute. Trump should be condemned for launching the attack, but applauded for aborting it. War with Iran would be incredibly destructive on all sides and would likely spread throughout the Middle East. If it were to happen, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists warns Trump could very likely order the use of so-called tactical nuclear weapons against Iran. In the midst of this geopolitical tinderbox, the Trump administration is attempting to deliver nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia, a key antagonist of Iran. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has not ruled out using the nuclear power plants he hopes to buy to develop nuclear weapons. Bipartisan congressional opposition to the Saudi nuclear deal is growing, not only due to the danger of nuclear weapons proliferation, but also because of Saudi Arabia's relentless bombing of Yemen, causing the greatest humanitarian catastrophe in the world today, and its brutal murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. California Democratic Congressmember Brad Sherman told Arms Control today, "If there's a government that you can't trust with a bone saw, you shouldn't trust it with nuclear weapons." Another concern in Congress is the potential conflict of interest of Trump advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Kushner's family business, their developers in New York, received a massive bailout last year, that building 666. I didn't make up the number. Kushner's family business received a massive bailout last year from a hedge fund called Brookfield Asset Management. Brookfield Asset Management also owns Westinghouse Electric, which would profit from nuclear plant sales to Saudi Arabia. And we know Kushner's strong personal relationship with the Saudi crown prince, right? Some call them the crown prince and the clown prince. You know, Jared Kushner, the MBS whisperer, who when Trump was in Vietnam walking out of the summit with North Korea, you know, you had a split screen on television of the major events of that day. It was Trump in Vietnam with Kim Jong-un. And on the other side, it was Michael Cohen's testimony. I don't think it was any accident that with these two massive, you know, headline moments, that's the moment Jared Kushner, I won't say snuck into, but quietly went to Saudi Arabia to meet with Mohammed bin Salman. And it is known that through the period after the murder of Khashoggi, Jared Kushner continued to speak to, and I don't know if it was advise, Mohammed bin Salman. I mean, even the CIA says there's no question that he was responsible for the murder of this Washington Post columnist. Now, one thing I would say, is that I bet the Crown Prince was shocked by the global response to the murder of this man. I am sure he was shocked. I mean, here he has been dismembering an entire country, Yemen, right? The Saudi, UAE, US-backed bombing of Yemen. Bombing it back to the Stone Ages, creating the worst catastrophe in the world today, a cholera epidemic like we have not seen in so many years. So he presides over the dismemberment of a country. He dismembers one person, right, in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and the whole world response. Now, they should. They absolutely should. But it is shocking to him, considering he's been responsible for the deaths of so many, and there's hardly been outcry. Interestingly, in Congress, there has been. And it has been Republican and Democrat, and that should not be minimized. And that comes from grassroots activism around this country, and it has to continue. With the United States openly gearing up for war with Iran, while actively seeking to empower Saudi Arabia with the technology it needs to develop its own nuclear weapons, is it any wonder that Iran has just announced it will begin amassing and enriching uranium again? Iran had been adhering to the terms of its multilateral nuclear deal years after Trump pulled out the United States of this agreement, but now it is moving forward. President Trump is forcing Iran to follow the route taken by North Korea, build a deterrent nuclear arsenal or be destroyed. Yes, we need a grassroots global response to stop this new nuclear arms race before it goes any further. Interestingly, you have the migrant crisis on the border, and then every other major news headline relates to what causes migration in the world, whether we're talking about war or the threat of war. I mean, what's happening in Syria, the largest internal displacement we've seen in the world, not to mention refugees leaving. And then you have the issue of climate change. Climate refugees, overwhelming their countries, and the Pentagon, more than anyone knows about this threat, says it will be the major driver of wars in the 21st century, climate change. Although, as we know, the Trump administration is trying to vacuum those words off of any government report or studies. But that doesn't stop people from acting, and it's amazing how much has been accomplished so far. More often than not outside this country, but people are organizing here. Our latest headline, Chubb became the first major insurance company in the US to announce it would no longer provide coverage for coal companies. Chubb's move, coming after mounting pressure from environmental groups, will extend its coverage ban to companies that produce more than 30% of their energy from coal. Marianne Hitt of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign applauded the move and said the insurance industry risks being on the hook for trillions of dollars in damages linked to climate change, from rising seas to wildfires and storms. Insurers are well aware of that danger and also well aware that the markets and the public are turning away from coal, which could leave them holding the bag for an obsolete industry. And then you have last month, June, the hottest June on record, marked by a record-breaking heat wave across Europe, which saw temperatures soar as high as 50 degrees higher than normal. 50 degrees higher than normal in parts of France, Germany, Spain, and Italy. Meanwhile, here in the US, record-breaking heat has gripped Alaska, exacerbating some 350 different wildfires across the state in recent days and accelerating the melting of its glaciers. And in London, climate activists with Extinction Rebellion marching on five major oil companies' headquarters to call for an end to drilling during London's Climate Action Week. Lola Perrin, one of the organizers of Extinction Rebellion, saying it's London Climate Action Week, and rather than network with people, we would rather go straight to fossil fuel companies and say, you know what? Don't explore anymore. You're not sticking to the Paris Agreement, no matter how much you greenwash it. I mean, Extinction Rebellion, this organization that has grown up in the last year, we were reporting on it from, well, just before the climate summit in Poland, when they started their actions in Britain and then inspired so many others. In fact, we learned about Extinction Rebellion the same time that we met Greta Thunberg. Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old climate activist that I'm sure you have all heard of now. She sort of co-hosted Democracy Now! For an hour when she was 15 at the climate summit. This climate summit we were at the United Nations, in Poland, the convention center was shaped like a coal mine. They were very proud of this. This was their convention center, and it was this black building that went deep down into the ground. And that's where I met Greta. She had come, she doesn't fly on planes, and she had come there with her father, who had given up his acting career to be with Greta because she had such a hard time. I don't know if you know her history. When she was 9 years old, she started to cover the issue of climate change. On her Twitter handle last year, it was 15-year-old climate activist with Asperger's. That's how she identified herself. And at 9 years old, she started to focus in on climate change, study it for the next 2 years, and then she stopped eating or talking. And her parents thought that she wasn't going to make it. She'd have to be institutionalized. They thought she was going to die. Her mother was a very well-known opera singer, her father an actor. And so he quit his job first, and he just was working with her and her sister. And she said it gives her a special perspective having Asperger's. She said, I see everything in black and white, and I focus in on one thing. And so last September, she sat down in front of the Swedish Parliament and wouldn't move for 3 weeks. and the parliamentarians would walk by and say, "You should be in school." And she would say to them, "I did my homework, that's why I'm here." And she has inspired millions of young people around the world. We recently interviewed a brother and sister who were 12 and 10 years old in California, who were leading the climate walkout in their school, Magdalena and Rio. And I said, "Have you heard of Greta Thunberg?" to Magdalena. And she said, "I love her." And they were the ones who challenged Senator Feinstein, you know, these kids who went into her office. Along with 16-year-old Aisha, we also interviewed. And they were challenging her, "Why won't you support the Green New Deal?" And Senator Feinstein got furious and said, "You don't think I know what I'm doing? I have over 30 years of experience doing this." She was shouting to the 10-year-old, the 12-year-old, the 16-year-old, and their friends. And then she said to Aisha, who is 16, "You don't even vote. Why should I listen to you?" And Aisha said, "Well, even if I'm not old enough to vote, I'm still your constituent." And Magdalena chimed in, "And it's our future." These are the people we're going to save, all of us. There's no question about it. Magdalena's mother, before the broadcast, you know, they went into a remote studio in San Francisco, and we're in New York, and we recorded them right after the show. And so the kids were getting ready like they'd never been on a TV show before, and they were setting up in front of the camera that looks directly at them, and they're supposed to look at it. And clearly, their mom had put their website underneath that they should say it at some point during the interview. And I hear Magdalena while she's talking to her, she said, "Mom, take that away." And she said, "What are you talking about? You should mention the website because you're going to lead this protest." She said, "Mom, that's cheating. I'm not allowed to look at something that everyone else doesn't get to see." These are the honest, authentic, wonderful children that are going to save this planet. And it's absolutely critical also that we have a media that expresses their voices, not talks about them, but like Greta, provides a forum for them to speak for themselves. And we need an independent media that, as George Gervner, the late dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania, would say, an independent media instead of the corporate media, which has everything to sell, which has nothing to tell and everything to sell, that are raising our children today. Well, as we talk about climate change, I wanted to talk for a moment about the real leaders in this country who have really opened up the discussion about climate change and brought it into the consciousness of the population of the United States, and that's Native Americans. That's the indigenous activists of this country. You know, we're in a presidential election year now, and you have the governor of Washington saying there should be a climate-focused debate. And amazingly, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, saying not only won't there be a specific debate on climate change, but if you participate in an unofficial debate, you will not be allowed in the officially sanctioned debates. This is what they said to Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State. I'm wondering if they're not concerned about what happened with the Green New Deal, which was, you know, you have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who even before she was, she officially became a Congress member, but after she won, she joined with the Sunrise Movement in protesting outside Nancy Pelosi's office, who was about to become the House Speaker again. And in the Green New Deal that they're shaping, one of the things that they were calling for is no one on the committee that develops the Green New Deal should take money from the fossil fuel industry. And I just wonder if that is why the DNC is so concerned about a climate-focused debate, is that it would lead to issues like this. But this is a presidential election year, 2020. In 2016, another presidential election year, that was the standoff at Standing Rock. That was this critical, historic moment. And that year, there was not only no question raised in the presidential debates about the standoff at Standing Rock, there was not one question raised, forget an entire debate, not one question raised about climate change. I raised this point at an event I did in Albany with Bob Schieffer, who, you know, the longtime CBS anchor and journalist, and he said, okay, maybe we got it wrong there. But let's talk about what happened in 2016. Let's talk about LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who is the unofficial historian of the Standing Rock Sioux, who on April 1st, 2016, opened her property along the Cannonball River in North Dakota and said, I invite anyone to come here. Set up your teepees, set up your tents, anyone who participate in the resistance to the Black Snake, right? The what they call the Dakota Access Pipeline, that pipeline that would make its way, snake its way, taking the Bakken, the fracked oil from the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota through South Dakota, Iowa, Illinois, then hook up with a pipeline to the Gulf of Mexico. And the people, the indigenous people, the Native Americans of Standing Rock said no. Now, they actually were not unusual. They were like most North Dakotans, because the North Dakotans of Bismarck, the capital, also said no, and their views were respected. The people who lived in Mandan, North Dakota, where the prisons and the courthouse are, the prison that has imprisoned hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Native Americans for protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline. These are in Mandan. The people of Mandan said no, and their views were respected. But then came the Standing Rock Sioux, and they just said the same thing, and they weren't so lucky. And so they rose up with the support of so many thousands of people. This was the largest unification of Native American tribes we've seen in this country in decades. She thought maybe a couple dozen people would come and she'd open up her property. Okay, a couple dozen people came immediately, and then hundreds, and then thousands. Native Americans from Latin America, from the United States, First Nations from Canada, Native Americans and their non-Native allies. They had to set up so many resistant camps. Theirs was called, I think, Sacred Stone, and then there was Red Warrior and many others. And they just started massing and growing, and they were met by a fully militarized rural sheriff's department. I mean, they would march on these back roads, and well, we got there in Labor Day of 2016. We were covering it before, but we actually landed on the ground then. And it was amazing to see. You'd have women in traditional garb, you'd have girls, boys, teenagers, old men, and they'd be marching on these rural back roads. They'd start with a water ceremony, glasses of water, and then they would move forward, but they'd be met by these fully militarized sheriff's departments. They would be offering them water and saying, this is for you, not just for us, this is for your children, not just for ours, because after all, they are neighbors, right? The sheriffs, the deputies, and the Native Americans who were there. And you know the scene, the militarized police department. They had MRAPs, tanks, automatic weapons, mace, they had drones, and this is what they would face off against, is they would get arrested one by one. We know the scene because we know it from the uprising in Ferguson around Michael Brown, right? Michael Brown is killed by a white police officer, and his body is left to bake in the hot August sun hour after hour after hour, and the people of Ferguson rose up and others joined them. And all these suburban St. Louis police departments met them with enormous force. This is recycling in America today. You take the weapons from Iraq and Afghanistan, and you give them to the police departments of the United States. That in itself is unacceptable, but that's what Standing Rock Sioux faced off against. But they kept going, and they kept getting arrested, and they just kept moving on. So we covered this Labor Day weekend, and on September 3rd, that was a Saturday, a judge was going to rule the following Friday on an area that they said, that Standing Rock Sioux said, was their sacred burial ground. And the judge said, prove it. And so they gave him a map, and their historians made this map for him. And then he shared it with Energy Transfer Partners that owns Dakota Access Pipeline, as judges do. And a group of Native Americans we are following, they're going to plant their tribal flags in this sacred area. And they saw these bulldozers excavating the area that the judge was going to rule on a few days later, the following Friday. And they were just furious because they realized they had given the map over. And they had, the bulldozers were way down the road, but they had leapfrogged them up to this area, they believed, to excavate the land so it would be a moot point when the judge ruled on it, and it would simply be too late. So they were furious, the Native Americans, the Standing Rock Sioux and their supporters. And they came, they saw the bulldozers, and they stood in front of them. I mean, this is a terrifying scene. We were just filming. It was so brave, led by women and girls, and they would line up in front of these six bulldozers, and these are vast, earth-crushing machines. You know, when we were filming this, I was thinking back to the Iraq War. Well, 3 days before it, March 16, 2003, in another area of the Middle East, in Gaza, the young American student from Evergreen College, Rachel Corey, in Rafah, in Gaza. And she was standing in front of a bulldozer that was about to demolish a Palestinian pharmacist's home whom she had befriended, the whole family. And she put on, you know, along with other international solidarity activists, the construction fluorescent orange vests. And they stood in front of these bulldozers and she was crushed to death. And when I saw these women standing in front of the bulldozers, that's all I could think of. But this time, the bulldozers blinked, or their operators did, and they moved back. And the people moved forward. Hundreds more came from the resistance camps because they kept hearing about this, and more came, and everyone moved forward, and the bulldozers pulled back, and it was then that the Dakota Access Pipeline guards unleashed dogs on the, they don't call themselves protesters, they call themselves water protectors. They unleashed dogs on the water protectors. They call themselves water protectors because the Missouri River, the longest river in North America, they say that if the Dakota Access Pipeline was built under the Missouri River, which it ultimately was, they feared that it would imperil like 17 million people downstream from leaks and other catastrophes that could happen, aside from just the destruction of the environment and continued dependence on fossil fuel. So they unleashed dogs on the Native Americans. And these dogs were biting the water protectors, but they kept moving on. I mean, they were maced, they were beaten by the guards, they were bitten by the dogs, and they just kept marching forward. And ultimately, they won that day at a ridiculously high price, but they did, because they would not stop. Ultimately, the guards, we filmed one of the dogs with blood, his nose and mouth dripping with blood. They took the dogs, they got in their pickup trucks, the bulldozers pulled away, and they moved on. And then we took this film and we posted it online that night. You know, I'm sometimes invited into CNN and MSNBC, and I continually say, why don't you cover, you know, the issue of climate catastrophe? And well, now The Guardian is not even going to use words like global warming. They're going to call it global heating and climate catastrophe. They won't just say climate change anymore. But I say to them, why don't you cover this more? I mean, why don't you cover this in your weather reports that everyone tunes into every 10 minutes? Because if you're going to talk about the dust bowl conditions of the Midwest and the fires of California, if you're going to talk about the record cold in the Northeast and the flooding in the Southeast, who's going to connect these issues? They're opposite. They're too disparate. You have to show the connection. And I'm not talking about Fox, I'm talking about CNN and MSNBC. There are two issues that it doesn't matter if it's a Republican or a Democratic president. It doesn't matter, even though now they are finding their backbone when it comes to President Trump, because he personally attacks them, names the networks, calls them the enemy of the people. So they have stood up, except on two issues. When it comes to war, and when it comes to climate change. On climate change, still you have these climate change denying weather people who will not make this connection. And when it comes to war, at the beginning of the Trump administration, when he bombed Syria, right, the 58 or 59 cruise missiles from the ships, you had MSNBC, you had Brian Williams. I came home late that night, I turned on MSNBC, and Brian Williams was talking about the beauty of the armaments. He said beauty, I think, three times in 30 seconds. The beautiful weapons. And then you had Fareed Zakaria talking about Donald Trump became president that night. And Fareed Zakaria on CNN said the same thing around the issue of the Moab, you know, the dropping of the mother of all bombs, that's what the Pentagon calls massive ordnance air blast. It's the largest non-nuclear bomb in the world. It was developed under George W. Bush. He didn't dare drop it. Obama didn't drop it. And then Trump, within the first weeks of his administration, just dropped it on Afghanistan. It's like a mile radius blast. No explanation. And you had CNN and MSNBC, that in Syria, talking about Donald Trump becoming president that night. And I dare say there may be some of that conversation about today on July 4th and what happened in Washington, D.C. But on those two issues. And so they continue in the information they put out. I'm not talking about the occasional special. There can be, but what counts is the drumbeat coverage. That's when people get galvanized, and they learn about this through the media, so it's absolutely critical. But back to Standing Rock and the indigenous leadership standing up on that day, September 3rd, it was truly astounding what they did. We posted the video. You know, I go to these networks, I say, why don't you cover this more? And they say, the host will say, the executives say, people's eyes glaze over when you talk about climate change. So we posted this, and in 24 hours, there were more than 14 million views that would make any network executive drool for those kind of numbers. So we went back to New York, continued to cover from there. The judge was going to rule on Friday. On Thursday, the governor of North Dakota, Governor Dalrymple at the time, called out the National Guard before the decision. It did not look good for the tribe. And also they quietly issued the authorities an arrest warrant for me. I didn't know it at the time. So Friday, we did our show, and then Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I, we were headed to Canada. I wasn't fleeing, because I didn't even know that they wanted me. We were going to the Toronto International Film Festival because there was a film that was coming out, you should all see, on the muckraking journalist I.F. Stone. And it looked at news organizations today that follow in his footsteps. So it's talking about Democracy Now! And I wasn't going to go, but I thought, you know, we just witnessed this unbelievable thing the previous week, and people in Canada care about First Nations. We should go and just describe what happened. And so we went up and we gave a talk that night. Next day we were invited to the University of Toronto. And it was, hundreds of people came out, and it was a bunch of people on the panel. And I was giving my talk, and all of a sudden I got a text that said, you're under arrest. And I didn't know what was going on. I was in the middle of my talk, and I thought, oh, someone just hacked my phone. And I was looking around at the audience and saying, who did this? But I did see it was a North Dakota number, and that did not look good. And it's not like, and I'm sure there are some of you who have had this experience, it's not like if there's an arrest warrant for you, you will immediately be arrested. But if you have interaction with the FBI, or with police, or with border agents, then you will be taken in. And I had to go over the border to go home. So I thought, if I could beat this arrest warrant going into the system, if in fact it's true. So I just said, could someone call me a cab? I didn't say what was happening. I just wanted to get back into the United States. So I did go to the airport. I did make it back to New York, and I did find out this was true. But I didn't take it personally. I really felt that, I really thought that this was a message being sent to all journalists. Do not go to North Dakota, which is exactly why we all had to go back, and we had to go back. And I also felt, especially for young journalists, that you have to know that if you want to, you know, go to cover something as historic as this, you don't have to get a record when you want to put things on the record. And if you didn't have the institutional backing, whatever, we had to stand up for you and to make, you know, really take these bullies to task. And so we flew back to North Dakota a few weeks later, flew into Bismarck. When we posted that video, and it, we had people like, not that there's anyone, anyway. We flew into Bismarck, and the same team, my colleagues, Laura Gottesdiener and Dennis Moynihan and John Hamilton, and as we landed, they quashed the arrest warrant, and they dropped the charges. So, but then I learned it was to bring more serious charges against me. So I called my North Dakota lawyer, not that I had one before, and I said, I don't understand, what does this mean, because we just landed here, we're like in North Dakota right now. And he said, it's not that big a deal. And I said, okay, just tell me what the damage would be. And he said, maybe a year in jail. I said, a year in jail? How much time do I have? And he said, 2.5 days, yeah, you're gonna be arraigned on Monday. So that gave us 2.5 days to cover the protests. So we're out covering the protests. And then on Monday morning, we had to do the broadcast before I was going to go to jail. So Dennis ordered a broadcast truck from Minneapolis, and it came up. And we thought, well, where should we do this broadcast? Well, we decided to broadcast in Mandan, outside the prison and the courthouse, so I could just turn myself in right after. And we broadcast from church property across the street. And we interviewed then the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux, Dave Archambault, the 45th chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux, like Donald Trump is the 45th president of the United States. And I said to him, have you been arrested? Have you ever? He said, yeah. Very early on in these protests, I was arrested. And I said, what were you charged with? He said, it was a low-level misdemeanor. Oh, I was being charged with felony riot. Like, I'm a one-woman riot? Like, what were they talking about? So he said, misdemeanor. I said, and what happened to you for a misdemeanor? He said, oh, I was strip searched. I was put in an orange jumpsuit, and I was jailed. And then I interviewed Dr. Sarah Jumping Eagle. She's the pediatrician of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. And I asked her, were you ever, she was among the first to be arrested because she cared about the health of the children on the reservation. And she had low-level misdemeanor. I said, and what happened? She said, I was strip searched. I was put in an orange jumpsuit and I was jailed. I mean, how much humiliation can a people take? I was at the Bismarck Airport one time and a guy came up to me and he said, don't think I don't know who you are. And I said, well, who are you? And he said, I was one of the guards at the site where you were. I said, oh, did you unleash the dogs on the water protectors? He said, no. He said, we were as surprised as you were. He said, Energy Transfer Partners hired 3 different security firms. And he said, When those guys released the dogs, we were completely shocked. And, you know, I always say, don't assume based on, oh no, he said to me, he said, you don't think I understand why they are so angry at us? We've massacred them for hundreds of years. Then we unleash dogs on them. He said, I get it. So I always say, don't assume based on someone's position what position they're going to take. Anyway, back to that day of the broadcast. We did the broadcast, and after the broadcast, hundreds of Native Americans came to show solidarity. They performed ceremonies. And right before I was going across the street to be arraigned, I got a call from North Dakota Public Radio, one of the longtime hosts there. He said, the judge is not going to do it. Because, I didn't say that on Friday. When we learned I was going to be arraigned on Monday, I asked to find out the judge's name. And even the lawyer said, because they're a close-knit group, the lawyers, the judges, and he said, it's absolute rubber stamping. Once the charges are brought, it's, so I said, just tell me his name, because if it's a judge, I think discretion, they have discretion whether to rubber stamp this, because it had to be stamped for me to be arraigned. And he said, no, this is automatic, basically. Yeah, he stamps it, but it's basically automatic. It was that pause in the basically automatic. So we issued a press release that said the judge's name, that he would be making a decision that weekend about whether I'd be arraigned. And so there was a lot of media attention now, right? A journalist was going to be arrested, so it was the homepage of the BBC and Al Jazeera, and the New York Times was covering this, Los Angeles Times was covering this, Vogue magazine was covering this. See why. So the North Dakota Public Radio called it, he's not going to do it. It's just too much pressure. He's not going to do it. But it wasn't only me. That day, Native Americans who face felony and misdemeanor charges had those charges dropped. This is what happens when. This is what happens when the media shines its spotlight in the right direction. This is the kind of reality TV we must all support. Not the kind he stars in, but the kind that shows the reality of people's lives on the ground, which is why the Pacifica Network is so important, why public access, CAN TV here in Chicago is so important, public access all over the country, community, college, independent media, websites, absolutely critical. I just want to end with, you know, the power of images. And I always end with this here in Chicago because it is such an important story. But you think about the images of that Salvadoran dad and his 23-month-old. And the power of this Mexican journalist, this woman who captured that horrific image of them drowned in the Rio Grande, and what a difference it makes when you show these images, when that spotlight is there, when journalists are there on the ground, when there is a platform for people to be able to speak for themselves, or horrifically when they can't, to know and learn about their lives. And the person that taught us this was a woman from Chicago, was Mamie Till Mobley, whose son, Emmett Till, we all know the story of. In 1955, Mamie Till wanted her boy out of the city for the summer and sent Emmett to Money, Mississippi to be with his aunt and uncle and cousins. He was at home with them, asleep in the middle of the night, when a white mob came, ripped him out of bed, tortured him, beat him, and he ended up in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. When his body was dredged up, and put in a casket and sent back to Chicago, his mother, Mamie Till, did something incredibly brave. She knew the worst pain of her life, her only child. And she said she wanted the casket open for the wake and the funeral. She wanted the world to see the ravages of racism and the brutality of bigotry. Thousands streamed by his casket and saw. And then Jet magazine and other black publications actually took photographs of his mutilated, distended head, and they were published. And they were seared into the history and consciousness of this country. Mamie Till Mobley, had something very important to teach the press of today. Show the pictures, show the images. Could you imagine if for just 1 week we saw the images of war? Above the fold of every surviving newspaper, you saw a woman who was part of a wedding party in Yemen that was struck by a US drone. And she described the couple who was killed, who was about to be married, and we learned their names. If the top of every radio and TV newscast told the story of a child in Afghanistan who had been killed, but we learned her name, we learned her stories. If every Facebook, every email, every tweet named a migrant child on the border, and we learned their stories, where they were from, why they were fleeing. Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. Democracy now.